All right, so today we're going to run through what I'm going to call a tips, tricks, and tools lecture. Going to show you some things I think will help you out along the way. Then we'll break off like we did last time, give you guys some opportunity to work on your RLIS project with your teammates and use that time effectively so you can get us a good initial submission for tomorrow. What I'll be doing for next week is sometime between now and Monday, well, I'll be emailing you and giving you a link to a site where you're going to sign up for a 30-minute block to meet with one of us for your team meeting next week. Okay, so we'll meet at that time, give you feedback. We'll probably, teams that meet with me, we're probably going to read your report live right there on the spot. So we'll walk through it together, offer you suggestions both on the report itself and the design tools. Feel free to ask questions. In fact, it's probably better if you bring questions you have about, I wasn't sure whether to do it this way or that way or that kind of thing. So it's meant to be kind of a discussion, not just, well, here it is, read it, and that's it, okay? So if you can bring questions, that's better. If not, we'll try to push you in towards a conversation about your reports. Those time frames, all three of your teammates need to be there. If you're a team of four, all four of you guys got to be there, okay? If it's absolutely impossible, if there are no times possible for all three of your teammates to be there, let us know. We probably can find a team that does work. If we're trying to find a time that does work, not a team. Time that works for your team. How about that? Okay? Make sure I get reports as PDFs. Properly name, copy all your team members on the email. CC them. Right? So they see you submitted it effectively. Right? And they get my confirmation as well. Yeah, that's one function there. Okay. Questions about any of that? Kind of what we have up in the next couple days. Next week. Yes? We still have normal lecture. Some of the hours will be during normal lecture time. So we'll have time set up next week that is at least partially reserved for meetings and then some partially reserved for you to work on RLIS with your team as well. Right. So to be honest, it surprises me a little bit every semester where my course evaluations is we don't give you guys any time to work on stuff in class, and we do consistently. So I'm not sure where those comments come from. But we're going to keep trying to give you time. Same will be true in the final project. You probably already noticed on the schedule, there are final project workshop days scheduled into the schedule already. So I think we do give you quite a bit of time to work on stuff in class. And we'd like to give more if we have more time available and more space available. Okay, other questions? Any questions about the RLIS? Oh, sorry, hands, go ahead. Go ahead. Yep. So the schedule, I think it's on the schedule for the week after Mardi Gras, I think. It's pretty soon. It's going to come up pretty quickly. Who doesn't have a kit yet? Okay, who's waiting? Okay.
It just shipped.
Okay, you guys are waiting for parts and stuff? Okay. So if it's getting close and things haven't shown up in stock, make sure you let me know. They're all alternative vendors for all that stuff. Of course, it's easier and you get to pay less shipping if you only order it from one place. If we're missing parts, I can give you alternative vendors and we can work something out. Okay. You got a question? Yes, sir. So, RLIS, the question is, do you have to do a morphological chart? In terms of including that in your report, which is probably what you're really asking, I think, we're not explicitly requiring a morphological chart in the report. In terms of the design process, yes, of course you should be doing a morphological chart. Okay. We're not explicitly requiring, but it also could help you explain where your alternative designs came from, right? It can also help point out big differences between designs and where they're accomplishing things. So it's not an explicit requirement in the same way that a house of quality and spec sheet and function tree are, or evaluation matrices. But like I said, you should be doing it already. So, okay. Other questions? Right. So, this lecture shouldn't take a whole lot of time, but I think will be useful. I'm going to call it tips, tricks, and tools. First thing I want to talk about, you guys are getting busier, I think, as students. You're going to keep getting busier. Doesn't get a whole lot easier from here on out. So I think you probably should start, kind of think about ways to manage your time. All right, and most of us never really get great at this. I'm just going to show you a kind of system that I try to follow. It's based on this book called Getting Things Done. And really the idea basically is to really take whatever goals or tasks, high-level tasks you have, and break them down into individual actionable items, something I could sit down and do right now, right? Trying to learn Japanese, which I've been trying to do for a long time now. That's a big goal. That's an impossible task. It's really daunting, okay? Study katakana for 5 minutes. That is an actionable task I could sit down and do right now, right? And what we'll see, and this will actually fit into project planning for an entire team in a similar way, right? If you're not able to sit down and prescribe your team's goals and your design into and divide it into actionable tasks someone could sit down and do right now, it's going to be impossible for you to estimate how long that project's going to take to finish. Right? It's impossible for you to estimate how long it will take to build an artless design. Right? You can give a guess, but it's effectively meaningless. Right? How long will it take for you to sit down and machine one wheel of this artless design or something like that? You can get a better idea of that time than you can of building the whole thing. Okay. How long, you know, so basically breaking things down into actionable, clear tasks is important. Especially you track them all. And the kind of idea is that your mind itself is a really poor management system, right? We're not good at keeping up just long list of facts effectively, right? And your task will always be there weighing on you. So use some system, offload the reminders and all that stuff to some kind of system that you trust. You can also group the tasks by context. So you have tasks grouped by project, and there's a big, huge, long list of tasks. You can just go through. They're actionable. I can sit down and do things right now. These things, check them off. Okay. It also has kind of a morale-boosting piece of it. If you have a learn Japanese, that task is never going to be completed. Because you always could be learning more Japanese, right? But do 5 minutes of katakana practice. Do 5 minutes of kanji practice. Those are things you can check off. Okay, I'm making progress towards my goal of actually learning Japanese, right? And that's going to be a big kind of boost for your morale when you're trying to do things. You can also group tasks, these task listings, by context. So I have some context in my kind of software I use for this. I have one that's called Focus, one that's called Dead, one that's called Dash. So if I have energy to focus on something, I can look at my focus list and work on things that, okay, I have energy, I'm well focused right now, I have good concentration. If I'm dead tired, right, I can go look at the items on the dead list and work through those. There's still things that have to get done, but they don't require kind of the level of focus that more important things might. Things that are dash or things that are quick. If I have 5 minutes to spare before some faculty meeting or something, I can look at the dash list and take care of those little items. Check those off really quickly. Okay. So your team can do something similar. But I think it's a pretty good system, right? So I have those kind of lists. Okay. There's also a list that kind of build on this for team management. We'll talk a bit more about team management. I think a lecture is scheduled for Tuesday. Kind of project management and planning tools. Similar tools and software exist for team managing team tasks. One kind of popular and free one for your teams is called Trello. Allows you, it's kind of shared boards of tasks. You can group by subject, sub area within your project, that kind of thing. Okay. Okay. So, inevitably in any project, you're going to have some software, whether you're the one writing it or not. There's going to be somewhere in your somebody in your project probably writing software. We'll talk a bit more about that coming up once we start the mechatronics kit. And then even if you don't have software to manage, you're going to have documentation to manage. Why do we do the things we do? We have all these versions of the House of Quality to keep track of, right? The documentation of communications with manufacturers, all those different things, right? Scheduling, timelines. I think it's important, particularly as your team grows and as your project grows, to standardize on file names, right? So you don't end up with a folder of untitled 1 to 99, right? There's no way anybody on your team is going to know which one of those is which, right? And you may know in the moment, but six months from now, when you've still been working on this project, you're not going to know what untitled 4 means anymore. Right? So it's important, I think, to standardize your kind of file names and folder structure across a project. Right? And most companies actually will have style guides for this. We're working these kind of documents in our company. We name them this way. Right? Because chances are you're not going to be at that company forever. Someone's going to have to come in and do your job after you and be able to sort through the work you've done. Right? So these kind of things are critically important to long-term, meaningful engineering efforts. Right? So we'll talk a bit more when we get to the coding about using version tracking. A lot of the CAD programs now actually have version tracking built in. You can actually roll back to earlier versions of your drawing really pretty easily. Right? You can branch off and try some ideas. Okay, these didn't work, and roll back to a version within the software. Pretty nice system that's existed for software stuff for a long time. So CAD software packages are starting to integrate that a little bit. Guess hold on a second. So using an automated version tracking system is worthwhile. And you want to have backups. We'll talk more about backups in a minute. All right. So this is what my group, academic output is effectively papers and funding and ideas. So this is our this is from our style guide on how our folder structures look for any paper we draw. Right? And I'm not saying you guys need this much detail for your group for this class, but if you're working on a larger project, you get to senior design, you're working on a project for a year, you might want to have something like this so that everyone on your project understands kind of how things work together, everything gets named correctly. You don't have to hunt through stuff you did 6 months ago to try to figure out what the heck's going on. Okay? It can save you a lot of time. Effectively, you're being kind to your future self, not just your teammates. Okay? So that's what one of our papers looks like. We follow that structure. Okay? Mentioned the version tracking. We use a system called GitHub. You'll see all the code we'll talk through in this class is already on a lab GitHub. I think I showed you guys a link to that the first day. It allows that kind of version tracking idea we just talked about, basically. So we use GitHub. GitHub's free. Right? You could use it within your team. They also have a pretty good pack of stuff for students, free server time, some software packages that are free for students. It varies a little bit from time to time. Every 6 months or so, they'll change it up. But free software, free server things. Some free cloud storage, things like that, that you might want to check out. Okay. This is one most of us have to learn the hard way, unfortunately. Back up your data. Hard drives die. Even SSDs, non-spinning disks, die. So 5.1, this is from Backblaze. Actually runs a kind of big server farm that does backup stuff. Their chart, you see, over 5% of hard drives fail within the first year. Right, which that's a fairly large failure rate. Then you have this kind of middle rate. You make it past the first year, all the kind of lemons have been worked out for those died already. And then after year three, you're getting looking at an 11.8% failure rate annually. So if you have a hard drive, you have a computer older than 3 years, your hard drive will be dying sometime soon. Okay, so have a backup of all that data. Right. So for example, I kind of forced this on my lab, my students as well. We had a hard drive fail in one of our lab laptops. That student was up and running that afternoon with all of his data intact. Right? So that's the kind of situation you need. Right? You don't have time. None of us have time to go back and recreate years worth of work. Right? So have that backup. You can be right back online and working right away. Right? So you hear people talk about backups. Talking about backups, one backup is actually not enough. If you think about those failure rates, you can do the statistics in your head. Or sit down on paper, probably. Two is one, and one is one. It's kind of the phrase you hear people say. So two backups is effectively just one backup, which is good enough, right? You have one, you might as well not have any. But I'm going to say one's better than none, actually. You can look at local backups. Both Windows 10 and macOS have built-in backup solutions, right? So you can plug in an external drive. External hard drives are super cheap these days. I think you can get 4 terabytes for less than $100 these days, right? It's going to be more than most of us need. Plug it into the Mac and say, hey, do you want to use this for Time Machine? Yes, and then every time you plug that drive in moving forward, it's going to back up your computer. And then it back it up every hour as long as it's plugged in. Right? Windows 10 has a similar solution now, right? So I have one of these drives running in my office. I have one of these drives running at home. I also have, and probably, if you're using your computer and you're depending on it for your livelihood, which I effectively do, I also have a byte-for-byte clone. Right? So I can, my hard drive dies, I can boot up into an external drive and run from that immediately. Right? Byte for byte, every little memory, or bit for bit actually, every memory bit on my drive is copied to an external drive. So you could do that as well if you kind of get serious about this. And then kind of best practice is even to have another kind of layer where you back up somewhere off-site. Right? So if my house catches fire, I don't lose all my backups in that tragedy as well. Right? So somewhere else, my data is somewhere else as well. So that's the Backblaze site. They do that. So you can pay a fee every month, and all your data gets shipped off to some server automatically. So backup, I think it's don't learn this the hard way. Have your stuff backed up. Okay. So let's talk about general software tools that will help you. I think most of you probably know that you can get Office 365 for free. So the whole Office suite of tools you can get free because you're a student here at UL. They have this deal with most universities. So there's a link to the help desk kind of link that links through to Microsoft for you to get those for free. So you can stay updated in the most recent version of all that stuff completely free while you're a student. They also have another list of free software. A few of the things we'll actually talk about because they're relevant to this class. But if you're interested in some free software, things that might help you throughout your career, there's a pretty nice list of things maintained by our IT people. Some of them will bounce you through portals so they know you came from UL and you get it for free that way. Okay. So as students, there are a lot of tools out there for you for free. There's two software tools primarily that we're going to use when we get to your electronics kit you guys ordered. The first is the text editor called Atom. It's actually made by those GitHub people. So we're going to use that text editor to actually write the files that we're coding up. So if when you take a look at this lecture later on, or if you remember, you might want to go ahead or you should go ahead and get this. We're going to need it in 2 weeks. Okay, this text editor. We're also going to use the few options for this kind of software. We're also going to use an application called CoolTerm. It's going to allow you to communicate with, so we'll write the actual code in Atom, and then CoolTerm will allow us to communicate in real time with the microcontroller. It's a serial, it's a terminal emulation thing, does serial communication. Okay. So you're going to need these two, right? What I flashed up so far are kind of optional. These we need, right? So you might want to go ahead and grab those when you get a chance. Okay. So, if you're inserting figures and images into your reports, when at all possible, what you want are vector graphics figures. Okay. What vector graphics means is that basically a vectorized representation of the drawing is saved. So it's not that this pixel and then that one and that one and that one all need to be black. It's that there's a line between here and there. Okay, so that's what's saved with the file, a vectorized representation of the drawing, not just a pixel map. Okay. What that means is because there's this vectorized representation of the drawing or the figure, it means you actually can zoom infinitely into that thing, and all the math still works, so that thing is going to be crystal clear still. Okay. If you take a bitmapped image, is what it's called, if you have the pixel by pixel one, and zoom in and zoom in and zoom in, eventually you see the pixels. So we don't want that, right? We want vector graphics so that we can zoom in, you can make them bigger within your figures, and they're still going to be crisp and clear. All right. So vector graphics, we want those bitmap-based kind of file types, JPEG, PNG. Bitmap itself is not so common anymore. Right? So most folks are probably dealing with those too. Right? And one way a lot of folks are probably dealing with those two in terms of this class, is taking screenshots of an Excel worksheet and then trying to paste that into Word. That's not how you want to do it, right? Because what you're doing, you're losing information. You're just taking a picture of the screen, right? So you try to scale that to the right size in Word, that pixel representation no longer matches the sizing of the actual document you're in, right? Plus, you take a screenshot and you end up with, you get little green squiggly lines underneath stuff that Excel will do and Word will do and things like that. You're making it harder. You're obscuring the information that's in that table, actually. Okay. So we'll talk about how to avoid those screenshots. Sometimes they are unavoidable. I have a few in this presentation, actually. right? But they should be an absolute, absolute last resort, right? Most software packages, every CAD package has an export button on it for you to get the figure out of. Don't screenshot and paste into Word, right? Use the export functionality in the software you have. Okay. So, software for figures. The free, open source, good enough solution for you guys if you want to do vector graphics is called Inkscape. Okay. Download, there's Mac, Linux, Windows versions. So whatever you're working on, you got a version. Okay. There's a series of tutorials that work through how to draw squares and circles and connect them and all that kind of stuff. And you guys saw in kind of our good and bad figure thing that that's all you really need is some combination of squares and circles and rectangles and triangles. Right, to represent how a design works, right? We don't need CAD drawings, right? So Inkscape's more than enough to get you there. Right. I think the tools, I forgot to look at them, tools in Word or PowerPoint, there are drawing tools there. I think they are actually vectorized at this point. So you could work from that as well. If you do want to do a CAD drawing, I'm not going to stop you, right? Fusion 360, I know you guys are going to learn. SolidWorks, not Fusion 360, but Fusion 360 is free for students. You have to pay for your SolidWorks license if you want SolidWorks. Right. So as a student, you can go, here's the direct link to the academic page. You can go get a free version. Right. There's also two kind of CAD-like, not fully kind of CAD in terms of what we would think about CAD generally, but SketchUp and Tinkercad are also two other CAD-like programs where you can kind of they allow you to not, Fusion 360 is a full professional CAD program, right? It's a big steep learning curve. These are meant kind of for beginners and easy, quick sketching. So they're, in some sense, they're better for this class than Fusion 360 would be if you're going the CAD route and don't know CAD already. But again, you don't need CAD, right? What you need is to be able to generate drawings that describe and convey the functionality of the design you're proposing. And that can be done with design drawings that are much simpler than those that come out of a CAD package. Okay. Questions about figures? Figure generation? Yes?
So how do you actually export it? Do you export it as an SVG?
And then export which one?
From Inkscape.
Inkscape. From Inkscape, you could go PDF.
And keep
the PDF is vectorized. Word, I don't know if Word traditionally, I think, hasn't accepted SVG, but it might. The most recent version, I haven't peeked at it recently, just updated not too long ago. PDF's kind of a vectorized format for the most part. So modern PDFs, let's say. You find one from the 90s, it's not going to be. But so yeah, that's probably the way to go from Inkscape. We'll look at how to get a table in just a second. Other questions about drawings. What needs to be on the figure when it's in your document? Ask you guys some questions. So I have this nice, pretty drawing of my design. What needs to be with that in the document? Yep.
The figure name slash number.
Yeah, so you're going to need some figure number and caption. Where does that go relative to the figure? Well, figure number and caption go
below.
If I have a table number and caption go above, right? Okay. And we'll see in a second, actually, Word defaults to that for you if you're inserting captions correctly. I think you're talking about labels of stuff on the figure itself, right? So I need to label the parts of the design according to their functionality, right? So those can actually be on the figure itself, right? Arrows pointing to stuff, right? Make sure you're labeling according to function, right? Okay, so I need labels according to function. I have a figure, number, and caption. What else? Yeah, some enough dimensions to give the scale of the thing, right? Is this Arliss robot 3 feet long? Is it 3 inches long? 3 centimeters long? What is it? So enough dimensions to give the scale of it. Okay. Other questions about figures? Okay. So I'm going to show the screenshots, and then we'll try to do a live demo of this. We'll see if the live demo works. So I have a simple table here in Excel. the shortcut, the rule of thumb for you, whether to decide if, should I label it a cat figure or a table within my document, if you made it in Excel, it's probably a table. Okay, so I'm going to take this small table and copy it, right? And I want to get this, whatever this happens to represent, into Word. So I go over to Word, and I go to Paste Special, either through the shortcut or through the menu. And then I can select in this menu PDF. And that's going to post a vectorized version of that table in your in Word for you. I can insert captions. Right? We talked about captions. Let's maybe we can walk through that really quickly. Insertion. Okay. So I can copy this guy. Go over to Word, edit, paste special, PDF. Okay. And see that's in there nice and crisp now, right? I can zoom into it, and it stays crisp. I can resize it. And it's still going to stay crisp.
So when you copy it out of Excel, it's going to be automatically a PDF, or we
have
to make it?
No. I just copied. I didn't do anything other than just copy from Excel.
Okay.
Right? And then when you use the paste into Word, edit, paste special, PDF. And Word does that conversion for you. And then we can resize and make it, size it up and down. Yes, sir.
Is that just the Apple version of Word, or is that just Word in general?
That's Word in general.
Okay. Just making sure.
Yep. Well, at least according to my search of Microsoft site. Insert table into Word. Google is your friend. Okay. So while we're here, actually we can bounce back to the presentation, we need to insert a caption. Okay? So what you need to do, what you should be doing, is inserting captions in your whatever application you're using to make the document. So I don't want my table number and caption to be over here in Excel. Okay? Make the caption in Word if you're going to use Word. Make your captions in Google Docs, if you're using Google Docs. Make them in LaTeX if you're going to use Overleaf. Okay. That's going to fix a lot of problems for you. Because now you rearrange the order of your report, I have to go back to every one of those figures and now change the ordering, the numbering. Right? So the document preparation lets you do that. Doing it in your document preparation application ensures that you're going to have consistent formatting and things like that as well. Right? The text inside Excel is going to be different than the text inside your drawing application, let's say. Okay, so you want to make the captions in your document preparation application, whatever one you happen to be using. Okay. In Word, it's actually pretty easy. I'm sure Google Docs is pretty easy, too. You can just right-click on whatever object you inserted, whether it's a figure or a table. There will be an item that says Insert Caption. Right. You get to pick whether it's a table or figure. You have to add in what the descriptive part of that caption is and click OK. Okay, pretty simple, actually. So we can actually do that live, too. Back to Word. So have this inserted figure. And right-click on it, Insert Caption is one of the options. Right. So I can insert caption. And I say, well, that's a table. Position above by default when you select table in Word, so it's going to do that for you. And then I need to add to the table some kind of descriptive caption for whatever that table actually represents. House of Quality, Arliss House of Quality, Arliss Specification Sheet. Okay. And then you click OK, and there you go. Now I have a table number and descriptive caption for my table that's made in the document preparation software, will match the fonts and everything I'm already using, whatever I'm using in my document. Okay. I'm going to say, let's look at that page. I want that table, let's say, to be a little bit larger. Okay. Still looks pretty clear to me. Okay. Well, let's take a look at the other solution to this. All right. So let me escape. And maybe I want to do a screenshot instead. This is going to be easier, isn't it? Let me get back. It's on my desktop. Got a screenshot into Word. Okay, well, there's my screenshot. If I want to get it to the same size, be like that. And I think probably hard for you guys to see in the audio. Oh, we can zoom in and see. So there's my screenshot compared to the PDF version. All right. So this is a bitmapped. So see, there's a pixel there that's black. All right. The upper version knows there's a line between those two places and draws the line. Okay. So that is the way not to do it, to do the screenshot route. Okay. Copy and paste special as PDF. What you're going to end up with, and you see it can get quite bad, actually. So here's a table, somebody's spec sheet that they kind of did via from a screenshot. It's impossible to read. Right, to give you an idea of the size, that text is still smaller than, so if they even zoom up further, this doesn't get any better. Right, even if they had zoomed out further or zoomed in further. Right, or you can look, here's a house of quality done from a screenshot. Can you guys read that? I couldn't read that. All right, man, I guess I can guess at what's there, but it's certainly not efficiently conveying the information that you want to convey, right? You're not making your reader's job as easy as possible if you're inserting tables that way. Okay? Okay. Let me go back to the other. Arrangement. So we went through that. And we kind of saw the difference. Okay. Questions about any of that? No, kind of quick run through of some stuff, but I think it can make a dramatic difference in how your document looks. And actually, if you're thinking about kind of documents that might be facing customers or professors as customers of your academic work, how a document looks does matter. Right? I think we don't like to admit that, generally. Right? As engineers, it should be just the content we care about, but how things look do have some effect, even if it's at a subconscious level. Something looks higher quality, we tend to think it's higher quality. Right? Documents nicely prepared, figures are clean and clear, you're giving the impression that your work is of higher quality. And that is of some value, right? If your work's junk, your work's going to be junk no matter what, right? But if you have good work, make it look like good work. Let how your document looks support the work you've done and push your reader towards believing you when you said you've done a good work. Okay. Questions? And you guys had no questions about the Artlist contest rules that might help you in your designs?
Would one of these designs that we come up with, could that be used in the actual contest?
Sure. So that's the option. Like when I introduced a project, right? You guys are at perfect timing to where if this Artlist project seems really cool to you, get in touch with me in May. Right? There's a lot of work to be done between May and August. To be a part of our team and push for your design or work from the students that are on that team already.
So this design, is there going to be like a vote on, say, all the designs, they look at them all, you guys look at them all?
So, so we don't do it quite that way, right? So if you guys were interested in being on the team, right, whatever subset of you that happens to be, whether it's one or 10, right, you can just get folded into the team, and then it's up to your team to design in that sense. So we don't take designs from this class directly and build and go.
Oh.
Yeah. Yes?
Is there like a place where we go look to see like everything that needs to be within the CAN set? Like the GPS, the port?
Well, I think... Yeah, I mean, everything that needs to be that fit within that volume is your entire design. So whatever you think the design needs has to fit within those volume specs, including if you're using a parachute, for example. That's included in that volume. Right? That's the volume you have on the rocket. You don't get any more space than those specs.
Well, I meant like a list of like common things that put in. Like, I know you have to have a processor and all that, like that kind of stuff.
Sure. So we can run down that list as a group. Let's see. So you're going to need some kind of brains, some kind of processor, right? You're going to need some GPS, right, to know where you're at. There's not really many other ways to know where you're at compared to an absolute position in space. What you need beyond that is a little bit up to what your design looks like, right? If you got motors, you need some kind of motor driver, right? And those are not big usually for this size motors, like a stick of gum, basically, is the size of that and almost no weight. Battery. Battery is going to be, I think battery is the largest mass you're going to need, right? And I think effectively what teams will typically do with the battery space, one set. Battery space is you design, kind of fill all the remaining space and mass you have with battery. Right? So you have some kind of nominal battery size that would make this thing work. Okay, we have 500 grams left over. It won't be that much. 200 grams left over. Can we get a bigger battery and still fit it in here and use up that extra mass? Because a battery, energy density is a problem for this design, basically. Yes, sir.
We'll also need to go and get like specs of all these items or not?
No, so for example, if you have some kind of driving thing, it's going to need a motor. It's probably going to be a DC motor. Right? You don't need to tell me what vendor. You don't need to say what the gear ratio is. You don't need to say exactly what size it is. Right? You need to have some idea of the size. Right? That Spark Fun site you guys order your kit from has a bunch of motors. You can kind of get an idea what sizes you would need. Right? But we're not asking for exact specs, exact torque measures, that kind of thing. Right? It's conceptual design, high level. How would the thing work? Yeah. Yes?
That was kind of along the lines of my question.
Yeah.
We don't list like weights on individual components. Or
yeah. So I think you at this point, you know, even if you were doing this outside of a class, this kind of loop through the design process you're working on right now, you're not going to have those numbers. You're going to have some bounds on those numbers, I think.
Right.
Like a battery, you know, 12-volt LiPo battery pack is not going to weigh 5 pounds, but it's not going to weigh 5 grams either.
Right.
Right. So you know, so you can have some bounds. So what we're looking for when we're reading about that is, are you at least in the ballpark of reasonable for the items you're proposing? So the question is, how does the loading into the rocket, that whole process works, I guess, in a bigger, more general sense. Okay. So the way the kind of loading works, you actually go check in, they weigh it, your whole system, they make sure it actually fits the volume. So they have, there's a cardboard tube, basically the payload bay. You have to actually put your stuff in there and show them that it fits. Once you demonstrate that and that you're underweight, they find a rocket guy that's ready to launch, basically, or a girl that's ready to launch. You go, they walk you over to the rocket guy. Hey, this is Sally. She launches rockets. Away you go. So at that point in time, you kind of are just following the rocketeer's instructions. Okay, now put your design in my payload bay. They button the whole rocket up. Then you have to walk it out to the launch pad, which is 100 yards, 150 yards from kind of the flight line where all the cars are parked and stuff. So you walk it from wherever their tent is, out to the launch pad, it gets loaded on the launch pad. You walk away, wait for everyone else that might be out there setting up their rocket to walk away from their launch pad, right? And then they get triggered kind of one by one. So there can be up to an hour between when you put your device into the rocket and when it actually gets launched. So that's another time constraint you have in terms of what your processing and battery power and all that stuff looks like, right? Normally, you're just in standby mode when you're in the rocket, so it doesn't cost you a whole lot. The cylinder has a bottom.
Okay, it just lights up.
Yeah. Okay. So you have the rocket shell, and then that cylinder, that kind of thick cardboard cylinder, fits inside that shell. And there's actually a Kevlar core between the bottom of the cardboard shell and the rocket. So I get the, actually that spits the cardboard thing out and hits the end of that cord, and but your device wants to keep going out the end, right? So you use momentum that way. So it can be not gentle ever, I think, but if there's no wind, right, the rocket splits when it's at apogee. It's at its highest point. So it senses that it stopped accelerating upward or stopped moving upward and starting to come back down, that's when it'll split. But if there's any wind at all, the rocket's going to arc over, right? So you can have some forward component of velocity when you hit your maximum altitude. But it's still going to split at that point because that's the highest it's gone. So you can get spit out at speed, which that gets kind of a more, much more violent ejection from the rocket if you have some forward velocity.
One more question.
Yep.
Whatever is put into the cylinder, can the device that we build, can it have loose items? Let's say parachute, or does it have to be one solid thing and then put in and then?
I think loose items would be okay. As long as they are, you could show in some way that they're not going to free fall. They do kind of check for that. That you're not going to have some object that just drops like a rock, right? That's kind of a safety issue. So they do kind of look for that and push on teams, and you have to demonstrate in some sense you have some kind of controlled descent, so that you're not launching missile, you know, projectiles, cluster bombs, or whatever out of these rockets. So a question about parachute, I'll answer that first by saying you don't have to have a parachute, right? You could be a wing, you could do quadcopters, there's a lot of ways you could slow your descent. But you can detach from objects when you hit the ground. They have to be recoverable, however. They're kind of strict about that too, right? The desert, something like that, that's right. So basically kind of the rule out there is you should leave the desert cleaner than when you got there, right? So they don't want leaving parts behind that you can't go recover in some way. And they're pretty strict about that one, too. Yes?
When writing the report, should we come up with names to designate all three of the designs?
Like, sure.
You can't just be design A, design B, design C.
Sure. So the question is, should you have descriptive names for your alternative designs? I think that's a very good idea. And I think you'll find that in some of our documentation that that's a good idea. The reason that's a good idea is that your reader is going to have a hard time remembering which one is which, right? So if you have wheel design, quadcopter design, wing design, or whatever the descriptive names are, that's really easy. I might have to do that secondary parsing to figure out which one is which. So you're making your reader's job easier by doing that. Saw a hand over here somewhere? Maybe? No? Other questions? Okay, so we have some time left, the kind of lab portion of the class today. I want you to break into your RLS teams. You have time to work on this, get together your design tools. If you want me to check through design tools and take a look, I'll be bouncing around. Make sure you've seen me before you take off.